I think we've got a pretty interesting mix of folks with you this morning to talk about a variety of different issues. We're going to start off with Kurt Klumpner, who is the Deputy Director for Animal Care Operation with the Oil Care Wildlife Network at the University of California, Davis. And he's had, in addition to his experience there, he had 20 years of experience with the International Bird Rescue Organization and has responded to oil spills around the world. To his left is Justin Ehrenworth, who's Executive Director of the Gulf Coast Ecosystem Restoration Council, or the Restore Council, as we like to say. It oversees the Clean Water Act fines from the BP oil spill. That's not much money at all, was it? Well, it's the middle pot of the three pots, right? Okay, so it's a significant amount. And he's going to talk about what I always call the world's largest environmental experiment, restoring the Gulf Coast. At the far left, we have Ashlyn Gorse-Cousteau, who's a producer and host with her husband Philippe of Nuclear Sharks, which was part of this year's Discovery Channel's Shark Week program that we all love so much. And she's a former correspondent and anchor for E! Entertainment. So I think we've got a really good panel to talk about some key issues that are ocean and coast aimed at explaining what's going on. So with that, I'm going to let Kurt start, and I'm going to go over there and run their slides for him.
Thanks very much, Mark. If you read the little blurb, it said a veterinarian. Even though I work at the vet school, I'm not a veterinarian. My boss was supposed to be here originally, and unfortunately for me, he's on his way to Malaysia for a drill, which sounded like a really great trip that I'd like to be on. But anyway, so go ahead, Mark. So as Mark said, I'm with the Oil Wildlife Care Network, which is run out of the vet school at the University of California just down the road. It's been the organization that responds in terms of wildlife in California for about 20 years now, close to 20 years now. And we spend most of our time in terms of being ready for spills. There are certainly a number of spills in California, but most of our time is spent just trying to prepare. And as I mentioned with Mike, we're involved in preparedness actually all over the world with a number of other organizations. Go ahead. So one of the things that I wanted to point out is that really it's only the big ones that most people are aware of, and it was kind of brought home to me because Mark mentioned a spill he was aware of just a couple of weeks ago that I wasn't even aware of in the United States. Usually we can keep pretty good tabs in the United States, but if it's something outside of the U.S., it's much harder to hear about, and so there are many, many more spills than any of us are aware of. Go ahead. But they really can occur anywhere, anywhere that there is transport of oil, exploration, or even fishing or recreational boats. There can be accidents and oil spills can occur. Go ahead. So just to give you an idea, in California, in 2012, the number of reportable spills, and in California is fairly strict about their reporting. If it's in the waters of California, any amount of oil is reportable, and you're supposed to report it, not to say necessarily that all of them are reported. If it's on land and isn't at risk to get into the water, up to a barrel can be spilled without reporting if it's on a facility or something like that. So you can see quite a few spills in terms of actual responses where OSPR or OWCN needs to go out and react. It's much, much smaller. And in terms of oil pollution and oil impacting the environment, it's not just spills. There are lots of other from what we would see as normal spills, other things that are impacting it, as you can see from this. Natural seeps, and particularly off of the California coast, I'm not as aware of some of the other areas, but there are many natural seeps. It's one of the reasons that it's relatively easy, close to shore, to go out and have offshore rigs. And so there's much oil that's actually in the environment from these little basically holes in the bottom of the sea that are leaking oil. During the Refugio spill, which was down in Santa Barbara last year, that was one of the challenges in trying to decide when they were going to stop the response, was that there were lots of seeps, lots of samples of oil on the beaches that were very similar to the oil that was in the pipeline. And so there had to be actual tests done to determine whether or not this was from the spill or if it was from a natural seep. Go ahead. And it's more than just birds. Go ahead. Again, these two are from the Gulf spill, but in any spill, any animals that are in that environment are probably going to be impacted one way or another, not necessarily die, but they're going to be impacted and their risk is going to be increased. Go ahead. So turtles, marine mammals, cetaceans, even smaller things that we don't necessarily have the ability to rescue or rehabilitate, like crabs and invertebrates, all the way up to whales may be impacted or are likely impacted if they're in the immediate area. Go ahead. So how does it affect wildlife? There are external effects. Go ahead. So things like loss of buoyancy and loss of insulation, particularly in animals like birds or sea otters that depend on their integument to be able to maintain their body temperature. Go ahead. And when we see that, we see consequences in terms of generally what they're trying to do is to get out of that cold environment, probably onto shore and stay warm. And so in most cases, they're not going to be able to feed or forage like they normally would. In many cases, that means they're going to become dehydrated because they're not getting water like they normally would. Because they aren't able to maintain their body temperature, certainly if there's any sort of a differential in the air temperature and their body temperature, they have to use more energy to be able to keep warm. In situations like the Gulf, where it was relatively warm during the Deepwater Horizon, it's less of a problem, and particularly for big animals, than it is if it's in the northern climes or in the winter someplace where it's 60 or 70 degrees temperature differential between the temperature of the of the water and the animal's body temperature. And certainly that's going to lead to starvation. Internal effects can be direct damage. Go ahead. So internal effects can occur because animals are ingesting oil in terms of trying to either groom the oil off of their fur, their feathers, or trying to eat food that's been contaminated. Go ahead. And also inhalation, particularly if there are fumes, but also with some of the marine mammals, if they're breathing when they come to the surface and there's oil on the surface, it's likely that some of those molecules are going to be breathed in. So there's injuries to many of the organ systems. And one of the things that we don't understand well and isn't obviously consistent is reproduction, but there certainly are reproductive impacts. And so how do we respond? Go ahead. It's not, in many situations, people think of oil spills and animals, and they've seen oiled birds being washed, and they think, well, all you have to do is wash the oil off and turn them loose, and they'll be fine. But that's not really the case. It's a bit more complicated than that. Maybe in the early days that was the case. Go ahead. So there are a number of different steps that we've developed to try to be able to do a consistent and a good job. We're still learning with a lot of these different things in terms of the best way to do it, and I expect that we probably will be for the foreseeable future as long as oil is spilled. But it is a kind of a step-by-step process that we fairly well formalized. Go ahead. So the first is to be able to go ahead a couple more. The first is to be able to recover the animals, and that's one of the hardest things in an oil spill response because in most cases those animals aren't in areas where it's easy for us to get to. If we're talking about marine spills, most of them are typically out on the water. They do come ashore at some point. hopefully still alive, but many of them are far offshore. And again, if we take the Gulf as an example, they were way offshore. And trying to collect animals offshore is much more difficult. There's a wider area. And also in terms of safety and getting permission to be able to operate offshore, that was a big challenge in the Gulf. Go ahead. The first thing we want to do is try to reverse the effects of oiling. So typically we will have what we call a field stabilization area. In some cases, in California, we actually have trailers that are built to be able to move to the area where the animals are being captured and start to do that. Go ahead. So doing things like examining animals, starting to provide warmth to them, starting to provide fluids and nutrition. Go ahead. Then when they're moved to the rehabilitation center, the first thing we have to do is document the shape that they're in. So we do a initial intake exam, and also we try and document the evidence in case there's some sort of litigation. So we take feather samples and swabs to make sure that we can document that those animals actually were oiled by the oil from whoever the responsible party is. Most of the time, it's settled out of court, but we want to have the evidence just in case so that we can document every animal if we need to. Go ahead. And again, in terms of washing, we want to stabilize the animal, give them food, water, warmth, give them a chance to kind of build up their strength again before we wash them, because washing is a very arduous process. Go ahead. Go ahead. Oh, sorry. The cleaning process is relatively simple if you know how to do it. You've probably all seen the Dawn commercials where, Dawn saves wildlife. We've used Dawn for a long time. Dawn has been, Procter & Gamble has been very, very supportive. Dawn isn't the only thing that you can clean oiled wildlife with. A number of years ago, there was a study that showed that Dawn is just like a little tiny bit better, and a lot of us who wash birds kind of prefer to have Dawn, although we can't use it anymore in the kitchen because of the smell reminds us of all the birds that we've washed. But any kind of dishwashing detergent, we found that what we're looking for is something that's safe for us and the animals, something that's effective against grease, something that we can find easily in a variety of places all over the world, and something that is concentrated. And so dishwashing detergents work pretty well. For that, there are other chemicals that don't meet all of those requirements that might actually take the oil off better from the feathers or the fur, but aren't necessarily as safe for either us or the animals. Go ahead. Once animals are cleaned, what we do is we want to condition them. We want to get them ready for release back into the wild in the best shape we can be assured of so that they're able to survive. Ideally, we want them to be able to survive. We want them to be able to go out and reproduce, even if it's not quite as normal or as quick as it was in the past. But we want to give them all the tools that we can so that they can compete just as if they weren't oiled. Again, I'm not trying to claim that that's the case, but that's our aim. So we condition them. We have pools or fly divers, and then they're released. And ideally, they're released back in the place as close as possible to where they came from. That may vary depending on what sort of species and how much they're migrating and things like that. But we want to give them the best chance to be familiar with the area, know where to find food, where to find shelter, and things like that. So ideally, we're releasing them into an area where that's relatively easy for them. Okay. So the principles are the same across species. Obviously, there are slightly different things in terms of food or housing or anything like that, but we found that in terms of cleaning and rehabilitating, there are a certain set of principles that we've learned in terms of cleaning animals, in terms of taking certain tests, taking blood and things like that to assess their condition when they come in and assess when they're actually strong enough to be able to wash, and other parameters that we use for release criteria to, again, measure how well we think they are going to be able to survive once they're out. Just to give you an idea, and I won't read all of these, and some of you probably are pretty familiar with these, but this is the Deepwater Horizon. Actually, one of the things that was interesting to me about the Deepwater Horizon was there weren't as many animals recovered as I would have expected based on that. And I'm not sure. I'm sure that there's been lots of modeling done, and this all make the statement that this is just my personal opinion. But obviously, again, when it's so far offshore, there are likely many animals that were never found, that they were covered in oil and just sunk to the bottom of the sea, or other animals ate them and broke them down and stuff. But that's something that we really want to think about, are what are the animals that are impacted. And again, one of the things that we need to do better is actually being able to recover animals live, because that's, although we try to get every animal we can and do the best job we can, we really get in some situations maybe only 1 out of 100, or if we're doing really well, we might get 10%. On land spills with Canada geese in a park, we might be able to capture 100% of those animals. But in most marine spills or areas that are remote, it's much harder to get get a high percentage of the animals. And so, again, I'm talking about all of this, and I think it's important to do it, but I don't want you to think that I think that it's, like everything's fine afterwards. It's the best that we can do at this time, but really the key is not having oil spills at some point. So how well do animals do to survive or to release? It depends on a lot of things. Different products can have different toxicities in terms of the animals. Different species are affected, and we are better at some species than other in terms of being able to care for them. Penguins are a species that we've gotten to be very good at. In a typical penguin spill, we would expect to see 90% of those animals released, or in some situations even higher. And in the largest wildlife response in the world, the Treasure Spill in South Africa, we're able to release, I think it was 94% of those animals, because they have a certain physiology where they're used to being out of water, they're very hardy, they're used to not feeding for long periods of time. Animals that are constantly feeding in the water, those are much harder animals to keep in captivity. So animal condition, the things we can control are the things in red: speed of capture, facilities availability, and trained personnel and preparation, which goes back to what I said about the thing I spend most of my time on is preparing, trying to figure out what we need to do to be able to quickly capture animals and get them through the system as fast as possible. Go ahead. So after release, it's always in the news. Depending on where you sit kind of in the response, you probably have a differing opinions about how successful afterwards in terms of survival it is for animals, and looking at the cost, how worthwhile it is to do this. I obviously have been doing it for 20 years, so you know where I fall on that spectrum. Can, again, take what I say with a grain of salt. But there needs to be more research done. There isn't great research. A lot of good research has been on penguins, because on penguins you tag them by putting a band on their flipper, so it's easy to see. And in most spills, it has occurred near their colonies, so you know where they're going to be. You can just go out into the colonies, look for those flipper tags with your binoculars, and you can tell who's surviving and who's not. And as I said, penguins do very well in terms of survival to release. And again, it's not like there was never a spill, but they do pretty well afterwards, and they do reproduce, not at the same level as an animal that was never oiled, but they do reproduce well. With other species that we don't know where they are, it's much harder to track. So a little bit about conclusions, and I assume that you're moving me quickly because I'm running out of time, so I have just a couple more slides. Now I know why you're out there. Go ahead. Go ahead. Last conclusions. One more slide. So impacts can be lessened, not eliminated, and it takes real commitment to be able to do that, to do the best job possible. Prevention, obviously, is the best thing that we can do. The fewer spills there are, the better. But also, if we can keep animals out of contact when there is a spill by moving them away from the oil, that's going to be better than having them oiled and come into rehabilitation. We can never do as good a job in rehabilitation as keeping them from becoming oiled. Go ahead. So California is really unique. California has really made a commitment, much more than any other state and probably any other place in the world. Alaska would be the next in terms of the preparation that's been done. There's good infrastructure here. There are lots of partnerships. I'll show you a map of the Oiled Wildlife Care Network. It's not just at California. You can see that there are – actually, we just added two members last week at an advisory board meeting. So there are 37 organizations all over the state of California that are part of our network so that we have – first responders pretty close to anywhere there's likely to be a spill, and we can draw on people even for a large spill from all over the state. Okay. So still much to learn, as I said. More needs to be known about prevention. We need to be able to initiate responses more quickly and get animals as quickly as we can. We want to increase our capture rates. There are lots of species differences. We just became responsible for inland spills, so now we have the responsibility to be prepared for oiled bears or oiled deer or beaver or river otters, and so that's something that we're still working on preparing for. And certainly understanding what affects the post-release survival in different species so that we can start to attack some of those issues. Okay.
You forgot that slide, the one of you bathing the bear.
There are many slides that I didn't include.
All right. Great. Well, good morning, and thank you for being here. Mark, I want to thank you for inviting me. For those of you not from the Gulf of Mexico, you need to know that Mark Schlafstein, we think of him really as the dean of environmental reporters in the Gulf, and I think that probably goes beyond. And if he paid me more money, I would go on and on about him a little bit longer, but it was he did more money under the table next meeting, and we'll go on. No, really, thank you very much for being here. I'm going to talk about segue. I'm going to talk about the largest environmental disaster in our nation's history. So this is not my talk is not to be confused with some of what's going on right now. In fact, we're doing some public meetings in the Gulf, and when we had our first public meeting in New Orleans, we had to compete with something related. It turned out that it was the U.S. premiere of the Deepwater Horizon movie starring Marky Mark or whatever he goes by these days and a bunch of other muckety-mucks, and they were all there, and but we still got a good group of people to talk about the response. The problem was that it generated this discussion among my colleagues about who's going to play whom in the sequel, the movie about what we're all doing to respond to the spill. But in all seriousness, of course, we all remember this day. 11 men lost their lives. Oil spewed for 87 days, was on our televisions, and for many of us, we still have the post-traumatic stress is a little too strong to go in and enjoy the movie quite yet. But if you go to the next slide, the key thing from my perspective that came out of the spill and created the job and the organization that I now work for, typically when there is an oil spill, it's called the Restore Act, but for time we can move to the next one and put this very complicated slide up there. Typically, when there is an oil spill in the United States, the civil and administrative penalties go to something called the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which is not a bad thing. It's a fund that the Coast Guard uses to respond to future spills in other parts of the country. But there was an idea, as this oil was spewing, from those of us in the Gulf and members of Congress and stakeholders around the country, that said, wait a second, why should the billions that BP and its partners are going to have to pay go to respond to future spills? Why not bring that money back to the Gulf of Mexico? So that was the main idea behind the Restore Act, behind this slide here, and it tells the first part of the story. The second part of the story was everybody agreed we should bring the money back to the Gulf of Mexico in Congress, but there were some different opinions as to what happens then. Some people said, cut five equal checks, give one check to each one of the Gulf Coast states, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. Keep the federal government out. Other people said, no, that's not what you do. What you do is you do a comprehensive ecosystem restoration plan, and you pick projects and programs accordingly. And others said, no, that's both those ideas are wrong. Figure out how much oiling each state received and give them money based on the amount of oiling. And other people said, don't forget about science and monitoring. And as you can see from this convoluted slide, the answer that Congress came up with was yes. all of the above. We'll do it all. So there are these different buckets, or pots as we call them. The first is that the direct component, money goes directly to the states in equal shares. The second bucket is this comprehensive ecosystem restoration plan, which I'll talk a little bit more about. The third, based on how much oiling the states received. Smaller buckets about how much doing a monitoring program run by NOAA. And then finally, creation of centers of excellence around the coast to do future studies. So the last thing on this slide, well, actually, Mark, let's move to the next one and talk money. So this is the worst environmental disaster in our nation's history. It's also the largest environmental restoration program in the history of the planet. I think Mark put it very, very well. It is an experiment. There's never been anything quite like this. I've spent a lot of time talking to my equivalent up in Alaska, a woman who was the executive director of the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council, and she, our first conversation, I'll never forget, she laughed and she said, it was hard enough with one state, you know, three state agencies and three federal agencies. You've got five states and six federal agencies. Good luck, buddy. And then she gave me some wonderful advice. The point is that it's an incredibly complicated experiment, but we have a lot of money. So the bottom line first, up to $16 billion will be available for restoration. I'll briefly mention the three main funding streams. So the first, civil settlements, that's the Restore Council, what I'm involved in. And again, the council is it's actually the newest federal agency in the government. We're still a startup in many ways. We kind of have a board of directors model, where the governors of the five states and heads of six federal agencies are our board of trustees, if you will. So the BP settled for $5.5 billion, Transocean settled for $1 billion, and Anadarko for about $160 million. You put that all together, you get $6.7 billion, or $5.3 billion if you take the 80%. So that's what we in Restore are working with, that $5.3 billion. BP also settled their criminal liability for $2.5 billion. And under the settlement, those funds went to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation for work to be done across the Gulf. And then finally, there's the natural resource damage assessment process. And because I work for the government, I normally speak in acronyms because that's, you know, and it just all turns into NIFWF and NERDA and RESTORE, et cetera. But with NERDA, there was a BP settled for or provided $1 billion in early restoration and then settled for another $7.1 billion. So you got $8.1 billion there. Grand total of $16 billion. It's really exciting. So we can go to the next slide. I've mentioned who's on the council. You see I mentioned the governors. We also have the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which serves as the chair, the Army, and really it's the Corps of Engineers that's most involved, Commerce, and again, mainly NOAA, Homeland Security, really the Coast Guard, Interior, and the EPA. And when I told my friends that I was going to take this job and I mentioned that, you know, 11 members of the board, they all said, you must have a real desire for torture. You have, you know, those 11 parties, there's more than, let's say, one opinion within each organization. But there's also a tremendous amount of institutional knowledge and ability. And if we can do this right, we will hopefully succeed in the experiment that Mark laid out. So if you go to the next one, please. We have five goals as an organization. We're first and foremost focused on habitat restoration, water quality, and we've recently added water quantity to that, which is important, especially in areas like Texas and Florida where water flows and the salinity basis of in number of key estuaries is very important. Protecting living coastal marine resources, which you've heard a lot about. Community resiliency. Those are our four ecosystem restoration goals as we think about it. We also have a fifth goal about restoring and revitalizing the economy. And our theory is that in the Gulf of Mexico, if you restore the ecosystem, you're restoring the economy. That so many jobs and ways of life depend on the ecosystem. So we really try to reject we call it a false choice if someone says, are you doing ecosystem restoration or economic development? We're not building roads and bridges, but we think we're doing economic development when we restore the ecosystem. So what we've done to date, as I mentioned, we're still a startup. BP settled just this past April for about $20 billion in the flows that I mentioned earlier. We've already put out about $180 million when you total everything on that slide up. Transocean, one of the other companies responsible, settled back in 2013. So for a couple years, we had $800 million in our trust fund, but it was very difficult to figure out how to move forward because – You know, you look at Exxon, you look at Alaska, we had no idea whether BP was going to litigate this for 10, 20 years. So we wanted to try to figure out how do you move forward while at the same time being in a position to adapt to how much money and when we're going to have it. So in any case, we put out a list of projects and programs that we've approved, which we consider to be foundational in nature, projects that we can build on now that we know how much money we'll have from BP. One of our challenges is that those BP dollars come over a period of 15 years, and so that raises a host of issues that we have to sort through. How do you move forward with large-scale restoration when the money's coming in over a 15-year period? We go to the next one, please. So our charge under the law was to do ecosystem restoration, quote unquote, without regard to geographic location. Try doing that when you have five governors on your board of directors. They tend to pay attention to state lines. So we thought to ourselves, how do we do this? How do we delete those state lines and really focus on the ecology? And what we decided to do was to adopt a watershed and estuary approach. So we really went through a three-step process, and I won't go into what we've done in each of these watersheds. But firstly, we looked at what made a water system, a watershed key, quote-unquote. So we identified 10 of them in our first round. Secondly, we looked at what were the ecosystem stressors in that particular watershed. And then number three, we decided, what are we going to do about it? And so we picked a number of projects. In South Texas, we're doing a lot of land acquisition and conservation. In the Mississippi River Delta, coastal Louisiana, there, as I'm sure you know, and Mark has been reporting on this for a very long time, we have an existential land loss crisis. So we're doing investing in a number of projects to try to restore coastal Louisiana. Different projects in other parts of the coast, one of the most challenging parts of the work is that the Gulf of Mexico ecology is so diverse. South Texas is very different from the Florida Panhandle. So in any case, the watershed approach allows us to adapt for those changes. So I think, Mark, that's the last slide. The thing I'll conclude with and then look forward to any questions you have. $16 billion, as I mentioned, it's good. That's a very good thing. As a federal agency, we're very happy that we're not subject to congressional appropriation. These dollars are coming our way, whether Congress, you know, whether the future budget chairman likes it or not. Those are all, again, very good things. The biggest challenge we have is that it's not enough. It's $16 billion is not enough to do everything that we want to do in the Gulf of Mexico. So there are really two things that we're very focused on now. We see ourselves at the beginning of this marathon. Number one is figuring out how to make sure that all those funding streams that I mentioned, that we're all working together. In 10 or 20 years, nobody cares whether a turtle was restored, turtle habitat was restored with Restore or NERDA or NFWF money. Nobody cares. We need to ensure that we're leveraging and doing the right thing. And then secondly, we need to figure out, in my opinion, how to attract additional investment to the work. So we have the $16 billion. We call it creative conservation financing. There are a lot of interesting ideas about how one could generate, for example, a return on investment for conservation work. So those are two issues that we're very focused on. But bottom line, at the end of it all, we really hope that, as Mark said, that this experiment is deemed a success. So thank you very much.
You got it. Well, I'm sure you all realize no SEJ would be complete without hearing from a Cousteau, right? I know it's hard to keep us all straight, but I'm the new one. I'm Ashlyn Gorse Cousteau. I married Philippe Cousteau, Jacques' grandson, 3 years almost to the day, and we actually met at a speech he was giving about the BP oil spill. So there's one good thing to come out of the oil spill, I guess. You know, unlike my husband's family, the salt of the sea wasn't born into my blood, but adventure and curiosity were. So growing up, I realized I wanted to travel and tell incredible stories. So like all of you, I decided to become a journalist. But my specialty is entertainment, and I see entertainment as a way of educating. And like each of you here today, I really do strive to tell engaging stories that not only inspire people, but inspire change. Now, as we've been talking about up on this panel, you know, we've been hearing a lot about the BP oil spill, but I wanted to take this opportunity to broaden the discussion to a global scale. And I had the opportunity to witness another horrible man-made disaster while we were filming a documentary for Discovery Channel, and I brought two short clips to share with you today. So, Mark, first clip.
but you might not be able to hear it. There you go.
Does that help? 60 years later, Bikini is still radioactive.
And I don't want to spend too much time here.
But life abounds in unexpected ways.
They're keyed in. They know that we're here.
The sharks are back.
Yep. Now. Oh.
But how is a mystery? Reef sharks don't migrate. So where do they come from? And how did they get here?
Right now we have about a dozen of the sharks.
Ashlyn and Philippe Cousteau
are
on an expedition to solve the mystery of Bikini's nuclear sharks.
I probably don't need that. I'm sure you guys can hear me, right?
Yeah, but you're being recorded. So.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you
actually. Oh, that's
one.
True.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for that.
23 nuclear bombs. That is what we dropped on those tiny islands. But 60 years later, nature is flourishing. I want to paint a picture for you. When I got in the water, I saw groupers that were the size almost of smart cars. I saw giant clams that I could almost hardly even get my arms around. Everywhere I turned, there were schools of fish that were just absolutely beautiful. And the coral, oh my gosh, the coral, the shapes, the colors, it honestly would have made Picasso himself cry. Every time I jumped in the water, I was greeted by hundreds of gray reef sharks. And when the apex predators are healthy, that's when you know the ecosystem has truly, truly recovered. And as we mentioned in that first clip, you know, our mission was to figure out how those gray reef sharks actually repopulated Bikini Atoll because, as you could imagine, 23 nuclear bombs completely destroyed the entire ecosystem for miles around. But gray reef sharks are considered non-migratory. So how did they actually get to Bikini Atoll when these other atolls were hundreds of miles apart? So we actually brought down 17 satellite tags so we could tag the sharks and see where their movement was going, see how they repopulated. But that's when we made another chilling discovery. Here you go.
I'm not an expert.
You're doing great, Mark.
While he's doing that, can you just say again why you tagged the sharks?
Yes. Yeah, so gray reef sharks have always been considered a non-migratory species. But we realized that they had come back to Bikini Atoll in these huge numbers. So we tried to figure out, well, they were all completely wiped out. How would they have gotten hundreds of miles from the last atoll back to Bikini?
Okay, let's see if we can get this one going.
It's the last day. We have one tag left. But now it's too close to sunset to dive safely. With so many sharks swarming at the surface, a tagging pole is our only option. So I volunteered to get it done in the few hours we've got left.
Jeez.
I try for hours for a perfect shot at a dorsal fin.
No.
They move fast.
Took me a little while.
But the sharks never stop moving, and their skin is extremely hard to pierce.
Try putting your hand back, covering the top.
We're running out of time to get the last tag in.
And?
It's not safe to be traveling out here in total darkness.
This is it, right?
Great reef shot. About 4.5 feet. There's a shot. Take it.
Ah!
Yes! You got it!
Did I do it?
You did it! Good job!
With the last tag in, the Cousteau's expedition is ending. But the story isn't over. Sharks naturally move up and down in the water column, so light and temperature change continuously. But tags on four of the sharks begin to send uniform light and temperature readings. And they start moving west in a zigzag pattern out into deep open water. These are the tracks a longline fishing vessel would make. Data from four more tagged sharks show the same pattern. Something is very wrong. All of our sharks were tagged inside the world's largest shark sanctuary, established to protect sharks from commercial fishing. And now, eight of our tags send signals that they're aboard fishing vessels. That means they were all caught illegally. So how many more sharks in the sanctuary meet the same fate? One satellite track ends in the fishing port of Baybay in the Philippines, another in the Leyte Gulf, and two more are traveling close together in the Philippine Sea. Yet another track ended at Apra Harbor on Guam. This part of the story is unexpected. Nature restored Bikini. But now, another kind of destruction threatens to wipe it out again.
The Marshall Islands established the world's largest shark sanctuary because they saw that despite the recovery to the island's waterways from the nuclear blast, the threat of humankind is ever present, and overfishing was undoing the region's recovery. Now, the Marshallese realized the importance of vigilance. Because while nature is resilient, it's also fragile, and we must be vigilant in monitoring and the protection of these systems. That's why organizations like SEJ are so important, because it gives us, as storytellers and as journalists, to have the tools to all remain vigilant. But as we know, laws alone do very little if they're not enforced. Marine protected areas are vital to the health of our ecosystems. We know that when they're implemented properly, they can improve biomass, biodiversity, and the overall health of the area. But just protecting these places on paper is not enough. It's the same kind of willful ignorance that assumes a system like the Gulf of Mexico can recover in just a few years. Thanks, BP. But I just wanted to show you that I saw with my own eyes, after 60 years, nature can recover, even after suffering from the worst that humanity can engineer, like in Bikini and in the Gulf. Nature can rebuild, but we must give her the chance, the time, and the support to do it. Thanks.
Okay, so now we're going to open it up for questions. Do I have any? Young lady in the back. And please, you need to identify yourself and speak up.
Okay. I'm Jess Burns, our reporter on the podcast. Actually, I had a question for Justin. I've lived in the New Orleans for many, many years of my life. And it's two questions, and I'm sorry because there's like totally different ways. The first is... governments down there are notoriously, money disappears, money does not go where it's supposed to go, and so I'm wondering kind of what safeguards are in place to make sure the states and the local agencies spend that money the way that it is intended. Because even like funneling things off for education, like things that are more acceptable, happen in every state when you have a big, huge pot of money, I mean, it's gotta be something. So the other question, though, is that whole system, even before the oil spill, highly altered, highly damaged systems there. And I'm wondering what the kind of the promise or the hope is to potentially return these ecosystems to something better than was there before the oil spill. Is this an opportunity that way?
Okay, so let me repeat the questions. The first one is... how do you make sure that you can safeguard where the money's spent? That's the short version of it. And the second one is you're working with a damaged system as we begin the process of restoration. How do you return it to something that's better than what was there before the spill?
Great. Well, thank you. Those are excellent questions. So first question first. You are right that there is an unfortunate history in the Gulf, but also other parts of the country, of federal money. And to be clear, the Restore money, what we work with, has the quote-unquote color of federal money because it was paid to the United States Treasury and flows through our trust fund, et cetera. So when we put money out and give money to the states or to parishes in Louisiana, counties in Florida, et cetera, we must follow all of the federal requirements for issuing grants. What we've done in our organization is we have stood up a very rigorous grants monitoring tracking system. I don't want to get too wonky, but recently the Office of Management and Budget, because of what I think is in your question, recognition that, you know, money walks away, they've really ratcheted up the standards. So I said we're one of the newest federal agencies. Big federal agencies that have been around for a long time are now transitioning to these more rigorous standards. We, as a new federal agency, are beginning our work with these new and very rigorous standards in place. So bottom line is we have our eyes very wide open to that set of issues. And frankly, we're doing a lot of education with the states and parishes and counties and others. You know, they're looking at us saying, wow, you're being so rigorous right now. We haven't had that experience with the federal government before. We get to point to, well, these are the new requirements, but we're also hyper-focused on the fact that, especially when you got five governors and six federal agencies on your board of directors, you can't have the tarnish to the brand, if you will, of seeing money walk away. And frankly, there's never enough money. And as I mentioned, we don't have any space for that kind of thing. In terms of the actual restoration of the Gulf, I think it's an excellent question. You know, in the natural resource damage assessment process, lots and lots of studies, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of research and study were done. It's probably, and I don't want to speak for that group, because that group actually has to spend money with a nexus to the spill, meaning that there was an injury and the dollars that are spent are being spent to remedy that particular injury. With our dollars, we actually can look at areas of the Gulf that weren't necessarily injured as a result of the spill. We can go broader. And so we are not focused on, quote unquote, restoring the Gulf in response solely to the BP oil spill. There are lots and lots of other stressors, as was mentioned. There are other spills. There are other factors. Coastal land loss in Louisiana is a huge one. So I don't think anybody who is involved would ever say, with all this money, we're going to make the Gulf of Mexico the perfect, you know, utopia. It's simply impossible. For better or for worse, we don't have that mindset. Our thing, and I'll end with this. Our thing really is trying to figure out how to get the biggest bang for the buck, and that has a lot to do with leveraging, tying different funding sources together. Thank you for the question.
Okay. Thanks. Yes, ma'am. Okay, I'm sorry. What was the
dispersants and plants?
Okay, so the question is dispersants and plants. Can y'all address those issues in terms of oil spills?
You're asking about the effects of dispersants on plants?
No, effects of dispersants on everything in the Gulf, and then effects of all of these on plants.
Do you want me to start?
Sure.
I think that I can't speak directly to the effects of the dispersants in the Gulf. We at OWCN, since the Gulf spill, have started some research on the effects, the direct effects of dispersants, the spraying of dispersants onto birds and onto feathers. And I can say, based on my experience involved in that research, that there are certainly a lot of trade-offs that I expect that we don't fully understand in terms of use of dispersants.
I would only just concur with that. I think that it's the issue of the use of dispersants in the Gulf has obviously been identified, but I think that you're absolutely right. There's just so many more questions that need to be answered before we can conclusively say anything. Briefly on plants, and I'll just use coastal Louisiana as an example. There are a lot of stressors on the coastline, and obviously the vegetation is a critical part to keeping that the land together. So the impact of oil, whether dispersants or otherwise, when you have a direct impact on the vegetation, you're adding yet another stressor to sea level rise, subsidence. So we know it is a massive problem in coastal Louisiana as well as other parts of the Gulf. But I think so much more needs to be learned to really pinpoint answer your question.
Just to add a little bit more to that, one of the extremely unusual things about the BP oil spill and the use of dispersants was not just the total amount of dispersants which were used, which was unprecedented, but the fact that a huge chunk of those dispersants were used a mile deep and sprayed into the oil. And there are still serious questions about whether or not that was an effective process and what the actual effects of that were. The bottom line is that dispersants are often used to make sure that stuff doesn't get to the shoreline, and this spill has raised questions about whether or not that strategy should be rethought. There's quite a bit of research that's being done. It really started during the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative, which is the $500 million that BP put up immediately for independent research, and some of that money's gone to that. I know the National Academies is putting money into dispersant studies. There have not really been any changes in what dispersants people can use in the Gulf yet, but they're still looking at it. So we're going to have to see.
Mark, three things to add to that. I'll give you three websites you can go to. One is GOMRI, G-O-M-R-I. .org, that's the Gulf
of Mexico Research Initiative.
Research Initiative, where you can find some of the actual
GOMRI.org
that have been done. Another one is gulfspillrestoration.noaa.gov. That's the official Deepwater Horizon Trustees website where they put their NERDA restoration plan and what the projects are. You can go in there by state and find a specific project if you want to track it all the way through. The third one I would suggest you look at is NOAA's Office of Response and Restoration. They're the scientific support component of any oil spill or hazmat response in marine waters across the country. There's blog posts there. It's a highly debated, as Justin and Kurt and Mark have all said, debated process. There was a conference and a slight revision in the application rules of dispersants that occurred in Alaska, I want to say about a year ago, with the Coast Guard, and it was primarily directed at how we would respond to
in Alaska,
still in the Arctic, but it looked at some of these issues of the effectiveness of dispersants, and we don't know a lot of how they interact in different environments too, and that's another challenge. There's a blog post on the ORNR site on why we did what we did in the Gulf, and it was basically a lose-lose proposition, and we took the less damaging course, what the consensus was at the time, that the felt that the protecting the estuaries and the coastal wetlands was more significant than protecting the potential deep water. But, of course, we don't know all the consequences of what's out there in the deep water.
Other questions? Let us get to other journalists first, and then we'll get back to you. Other journalists?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. It's Amy West, yes. Sort of tied in with all this. You kind of started to say it, but I just come back from the International Deep Sea Coral Symposium, where they did talk about these subsystems and the core exit and the effects on animals. It was actually more of an effect with core exit than oil by itself. But the question I have is: these are the things we can all see. What about what? Money is going to some of the deeper ecosystems. Is it very specific focus? It's probably for Justin.
Yeah. So I mentioned the $8.1 billion that's going to the natural resource damage assessment. There's about $1.2 billion there that is going to blue water, open ocean. So while, for example, the funds that we oversee are not – it's not impossible that we couldn't do some deep water restoration, I think it's most likely because – of the way that the settlement with BP was structured, especially on the NERDA side, that $1.2 billion was identified for exactly this purpose. My guess is that will be the money, and that the Natural Resource Damage Trustee Council will probably be at the tip of the spear. I think that the probability is that our funds and the funds of the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation will be much more focused on coastline and in approximately 25 miles.
Other journalists first? Justin?
Mm-hmm. I'm Justin Kenny with the Walton Kenny Foundation. I'm here with you at NOAA.
That's right.
The NERDA money, the $8.1 million, just remind me again, who's in charge of that? And then how do the three of you, so NERDA, NIFLF, and RESTORE, how does that work? And then a sense of timing. We're still in hurricane season. There's a lot going on. I'm sure there's a desire to get moving fast, but what's the right balance between getting projects underway and getting the right projects underway? It's a sense of what the timing will be on stuff going in. And then a little bit for Ashton, too. This is a great storytelling opportunity. That may not be your primary focus, but how do we do that? How do we plug in to the stories that are going to be happening around this restoration?
Do you want to repeat?
I wish
I had a pet. I'm not prepared.
Running, yeah. A sense of the timing of projects and then the storytelling opportunity.
Okay, so it's NERDA money. The timing of the projects, right.
And then just a little bit about the storytelling opportunities.
Okay, and storytelling opportunities that are there.
Okay, well, I'll address the first two and then ask for some help on the third. So the NERDA money, there's a grand total of about $8.1 billion. BP, before the settlement in April of this year, they put forward $1 billion in quote unquote early restoration. So it's really with the settlement another $7.1 billion. Those funds are controlled by a trustee council, just as there was up in Alaska. There's a Exxon Valdez oil spill trustee council. In the Gulf, there's the Gulf of Mexico NERDA trustee council. And there you have, again, the five Gulf Coast states. You also have NOAA, you have the Department of Interior, EPA, and USDA. So grand total of nine trustees. Now with the settlement, that process is moving into it's now getting further defined. So there are now, I promise lots of acronyms, I work for the government, TIGs, Trustee Implementation Groups. Hashtag TIGs. First there were TWIGs, now there are TIGs. I'm not kidding, that's true. Anyway, there are now I think the NERDA theory is somewhat similar to what I mentioned about focusing on watersheds and estuaries. It's very difficult if you're going to say, all right, we're all going to do this together and we're all going to make joint decisions. Rather, there are now these groups, one for each state. There's an open ocean blue water TIG that I mentioned. There's also a Gulf-wide TIG. So that's what's happening on the NERDA side. To your second question, which I think, in my opinion, is probably one of the most, if not the most important question, how are we all working together? One of the things that we're talking about right now, our organization has we have mentioned our comprehensive plan. We have a draft comprehensive plan update that is out for public comment right now. And so the key part, in my opinion, of that document is that we, the Restore Council, are going to be hosting coordination, collaboration meetings across the Gulf of Mexico in 2017. And this ties to the answer of the timing. Our idea is that because the rules of each funding stream are a little bit different, NERDA is perhaps the most constrained. Every dollar that the NERDA Trustee Council spends must have a direct nexus to the spill. So if you're trying to put the chessboard together of how do all these funds, how do you get the biggest bang for the buck, my brief example that I love is Apalachicola Bay in the Gulf in Florida. They have wonderful oysters, but the oyster industry has really suffered. So if you wanted to restore it, how could you harness the funds of all three sources to get something bigger? theoretically in NERDA, you could do oyster restoration, lay culch. With NIFWIF, you could do some water quality projects. With RESTORE, with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we could work with private landowners to put best management practices in place so that, you know, this is a quick and simple example, but that the grand total would be investments of all the funding streams trying to get something bigger. Restore the oyster industry. Don't just lay culch and expect it to, you know, be good for many years. Address the underlying ecological stressors. So in any case, we really hope that by sponsoring these meetings in strategic places across the Gulf, we can bring people together and not just leverage the three funding sources, but bring in Farm Bill, bring in, you know, all sorts of other federal and state programs so that we're all working together. I do think that we really need to, and this is where I'll transition, we really need help telling the story, and I'm very happy that we've met because we'd love you to come back to the Gulf of Mexico. You should answer this question. But it's very, at the end of the day, as I mentioned, no one cares whether it came from this acronym or that acronym. What we want to be able to do is say, this is the largest environmental disaster in our nation's history, and we're all working together to make the most of it. So please help with that issue.
You got
issue.
It. Well, and I think that, you know, never discard the message of hope. Especially in this, because everything we hear about this oil spill is just very sad and depressing. And I think that vision of hope, and honestly, that's why I wanted to show you guys Nuclear Sharks. Like, it came back after we vaporized islands, and it was able to come back and restore. You know, and the facts and figures are so important in stories like this because people really do want to know the facts and figures, but make sure you have those human touch points. Like Justin was just talking about the oyster farmers. People want to see that. They want to see those farmers and how their lives have been affected and how their families' lives have been affected. And then on another note is I have a love-hate relationship with social media. I'm sure you all do too because it's now part of our jobs. But animal videos are the most shared videos on the internet. So not for nothing. If you can get a cute, fluffy animal in there that's injured and it feels better now, like a bird, people love it and they share it. So also don't discount kind of the low-hanging fruit, which are cute, fluffy animals. But also that human impact is so important story in telling these stories.
So oyster videos probably wouldn't.
Yeah, maybe not oyster videos. dolphins work.
Yeah, you do the oyster videos at Acme Oyster House.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
I want to add one.
Okay, go ahead, Ben.
For stories, you know, track the websites of these different organizations. They oftentimes provide short vignettes of type stories, and on the trustee site, you can go to each project and kind of follow it as it develops, what its fundings are, what its purposes are, and develop stories out of that. One of the things that I guess I said yesterday in my remarks, I don't know where, well, it might have been in the oceans panel here, was that this is more than just an environmental story. It is a people
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
an economic story.
That's right. Yeah.
And oftentimes you find it hard to sell a green story to an editor. But you sell an economic story and then explain how the green side built in. It's just, there's so much there.
Okay.
And there's a public meeting on the trustee committee on the 28th of November.
That's true. The same night as Saints football game.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
And they're playing Atlanta, 10-year anniversary of the first one after Katrina. Other questions? Yes, ma'am, in the back. Okay, so the first question is, what about wildlife restoration networks in other states? The other question is about more about entertainment, the use of entertainment for the covering environmental issues. How's that?
In terms of networks, unfortunately, the world revolves around money, and the reason that the one of the reasons that the Oiled Wildlife Care Network is successful in California is because it's funded through the state, through OSPR, and there's good support for it. Most of the other states in the U.S. don't have that sort of commitment or support in terms of money. Alaska, again, being a big oil production state and having suffered the Exxon Valdez, is much more willing to require industry to do that. But there are very few other states that, that's really the case. In terms of networks, I guess one of the most exciting things that's really going on now is there's actually a project that is being partially funded by industry on a global scale. It's called the Global Oiled Wildlife it's GOWRS, and now I can't remember exactly what it stands for. But when I mentioned my boss is in Malaysia, it's actually working as part of that. And it's 11 organizations around the world, South Africa, South America, North America, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, that are actually, again, building a network to be able to respond particularly to certainly to industry spills, but also to orphan spills where it's a tanker or something that goes aground in an island that there's no support to be able to respond. And I think that certainly networks are really a key to be able to do both large-scale response locally, but also kind of worldwide remote responses.
And Carrie, I would say that for me, where the intersection of science and entertainment come into each other, I'm always very honest about myself, and I'm a journalist, but I hope to be a citizen scientist. I don't know who's more surprised about that surface tag, me or the shark, that it actually went in. But one thing that I really try to do, and my husband also, is we want to make science and STEM as a whole cool and engaging, and especially to young women. So when we were trying to figure out who was going to put that surface tag in, everybody was like, Ashlyn has to do it. I was the only female on a boat with 17 men for 2.5 weeks. And we just thought it was really important for young women to see that, to say, oh, I could do that. That's cool. So for us, I think as Philippe and I are making these documentaries and these television shows, it has to be entertaining or people aren't going to watch. We really want to try to reach the GP, the general public, who normally wouldn't care about sharks or about marine ecosystems because they're the people that watch Shark Week on Discovery Channel. So it's really trying to get them involved, get them entertained. We call it stealth conservation. So once they come off that show, I can't tell you all the feedback that we got, which was, this is ridiculous. I can't believe this is happening. How can I stop this? And it was from people from all ages, from all over the country. So for us, I think it's just, how do you make science entertaining, but also not discredit how important the real hard science is? And that's why we had a marine biologist with us, because I'm not a marine biologist. Philippe is not a marine biologist. So we wanted to make sure that we had somebody there that knew all the facts and figures and knew, you know, to lead us correctly down this path. It was actually fun. I liked that you guys kind of giggled in a few points because that's what we wanted. We wanted people to get engaged. And I think that's when entertainment and pop culture can actually be powerful if it's actually focused in the right area.
So I'm going to take moderator's opportunity here. And, Kurt, I'm going to ask you a tough question as a result of the recent events that I just went through, which was that we had a small spill a couple weeks ago in South Louisiana where a marsh buggy excavator cut through a pipeline while building a restoration project funded with BP oil spill money. This circle may never be unbroken here, okay? But one of the problems here is that I am trying desperately to get the Coast Guard and whoever else is involved to immediately respond to this and just lay it out and explain what is going on. And unfortunately, what they did was they set up a unified command involving the responsible party, and the result of that was that nothing came out for like 5 days, and we ended up getting independent photos, which finally broke the logjam. Do you have problems as a responder dealing in a unified command situation?
Well, I mean, I
who do you take your orders from? Let me put it that way. We'll start with that.
Well, typically I take my orders from my boss who went to Malaysia, because he's the usually either the branch director or the deputy branch director. I don't know how familiar you guys are with ICS, but it's a system that they use for a number of disasters, including firefighters. And I think that overall it's been very helpful over the last 20 years as it's become more used. But I agree certainly that the information flow and a spill, it's one of the reasons that no one wants to tell you what's going on is because they're pretty sure that whatever the report was initially of the amount of oil, it's going to double or triple or 10 times eventually. And so they're worried about that. But also with social media and the impacts of social media that you're talking about, it's become a whole different ballgame for the public information officers and stuff. And again, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think that in some ways, it's helpful because more people know things, but also it's become more of a hindrance in terms of people not wanting to communicate in clear ways about what's really going on, that people are worried that they're going to say something wrong, and it's suddenly going to be all over the internet, and it's much harder to take things back or walk things back these days.
I have a question for our entertainment reporter at the end and our shark reporter at the end, and that is that I know that this year the Shark Week also came at about the same time as the premiere of Sharknado 5. And having been a guest speaker at all five premieres at a local pizza parlor in New Orleans where they've been screened. My question is, all of the positives that come out of what kind of a show that you're doing, mm-hmm. how does Sharknado 5 and the Sharknado series, what is it doing for the public's understanding of the risks of sharks?
It's giving Tara Reid a paycheck. That's what Sharknado is doing. No, I think it's one of those things where you watch it. I've actually never seen it, I have to say that. But it's hopefully people realize that sharks aren't going to come out of the sky and eat them. I'm sure there's some people that do think that. Bless their hearts.
In downtown Las Vegas.
As we say in the South. But when I think of what Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws, he always said that he felt guilty to the day he died for writing that film. Because that is really one of the largest, that is the worst thing that has happened to sharks ever was Jaws. So I feel like Sharknado, I feel like it's so chug-in-cheek that hopefully people don't really think that, but given our political standing these days, anything's possible in this country. So I hope that movies like that either make people want to learn more about sharks. Hopefully they see that as just entertainment. And I have to say, I was really excited that Discovery Channel actually even greenlit this because this is something that they usually don't do. I mean, it's like Air Jaws 12 this year. So I think that there's a lot of companies that can do a lot more on the education side of sharks rather than fear mongering. But yeah, Sharknado, dear Lord, I guess it's just giving D-list celebrities a paycheck.
just to be clear, this year I was interviewing the shark expert at the New Orleans Aquarium as part of that process. So
thank
it
you,
was
Mark.
Fun.
Thank you for that.
Okay, time for one last question.
Lineup in the Discovery Channel.
Yep.
So I've always wondered whether we object to sensationalism. mixed, but if we go too far toward education, we're going to lose that, the public, right? So how do you strike the balance there? And it's related to what you just showed, because these stories of the resilience of the ocean give people hope. You know, we've always been better at the I have a nightmare speech than the I have a dream speech in the conservation community. And so how do you strike, you know, Steve Blumby wrote The Death and Life of Monterey Bay, about the rebirth of Monterey Bay after the, it was a dead zone back in the sardine era. The Gulf, you know, the Gulf of Alaska, the restoration of the nuclear zone in Bikini. The ocean has this remarkable resilience that's starting to come out now. But how do you strike that balance? Maybe it was the previous question, entertainment and education, but sensationalism versus education.
So how do you strike the balance between sensationalism and education in dealing with these issues?
Well, you're completely right, Mike. Shark Week makes discoveries year. Like, that is the one week that they then tell their advertisers, we got 37 million viewers on that one week. But the good thing is not only did Philippe and I have that show was the highest rated show across cable that entire night. We beat Rizzoli and Niles. Philippe's mom was, like, really impressed by that. I was like, okay. So we beat – that was the highest-rated show that night, and we were the highest-rated show for Shark Week. And the fact that our show actually was the most educational show really felt like it is kind of turning a tide for people. Now, I also think that you're right. You still want people – the first cut of our documentary was very, very sciencey. It was very first we went here, we tagged this shark, then we went here, we tagged this shark, and I didn't even enjoy watching it. So we had to sit there and we had to try to build up the drama a little bit. We had to actually show me cursing when I missed that shark the first time. But I feel like that, to bring in a little bit of that entertainment factor is kind of what pushed us over the edge, so it wasn't boring. But on the same side, you see those shows that are just totally over the top, and I do think that audiences, thank goodness, I think the pendulum is finally swinging back where people aren't watching the Kardashians that much anymore because they realize that it's all fake. And I think it's starting to come back where we're seeing smarter television is starting to get higher ratings. So I think that it still needs to be entertaining and have fun, but I thankfully think that we are seeing the decline of just those sensationalism. At least the viewers are not watching, so that means the networks won't be far behind.
So I want to thank all of our panelists today. I think they did a really great job. And y'all are now free to go to coffee break for a couple of minutes before the next batch of things. So let's hear it for our panelists.
And thank you. Thank you, Mark.